acted the opening of the palace festivities, which were quite quaint in a woodsy sort of way, and the locals were quite happy to have an influx of 7,000 fresh purses, weary from the road and ready for some recreation. I don't think the local whores have ever been so busy. Don't count on it, I said dryly. But the good count arrived with his party. Every one of them, Planus assured. We had a bit of trouble coming through northern Gilmora, but once we got to Cleston, everything was fine. I made a profit, too, once they arrived. Thanks to your apprentice and that sneaky young man, there was plenty of fodder, food and supplies to sell to their procurers once they came to market. And they have no idea where it came from, I asked, curious, or how it got there. None, Planner said happily. They just see me as admirably well-connected, particularly since the steward of Verone has restricted sale of certain items in the city's market due to the war. But there is a sufficiency to see their entire army up the road to Tudri and beyond, from what they have said. At least that is their plan, from what they freely tell me in the taverns. And what is that plan? I asked. This was the important part. And when will they be moving out? Count Anvaram prepares to depart Verone within the next few days, thence to lay waste to the uncouth-sounding mage law. He is still quite adamant about his honour. I do hope you'll be in a position to meet him properly on the field, he said, a note of uncertainty in his voice. I take it news has arrived in Verone, I commented. It is said that one of the iron-banned castles was defeated, he said, as if the entire thing might be rumour. It has, I agreed, reluctantly, and the castle at Iron Hill was betrayed by its lady and has also fallen. Megalyn is under heavy siege. You can't wince in mind-to-mind communication, but I had no difficulty imagining Planus doing just that. So, is the war lost, then? He asked, even more hesitantly. Far from it, I assured. There is still plenty of fighting ahead, and perhaps even a chance at decisive victory. But feel free to discuss how inept and careless I am to our Gilmoran friends. Play up the bad news. I'm sure they would love to hear that sort of thing. Understood, my friend, Planus agreed. That will be quite entertaining. I'd never thrive as a soldier, but I'm quite enjoying playing the role of a camp follower. I haven't had this much fun since I helped Zagor out with that monk. That took me aback. You're hanging around with Zagor? I asked skeptically. You two are about as different as iron and salt. Yet he remains a charming fellow, once you get past the rustic wilderland's accent, Planus countered. But let me go seed your disinformation among your foes. I do hope it bears fruit. Once our contact was broken, I took a few moments to finish up my meal, before I contacted first Gareth and then Carmella, seeking to get news and deliver a few orders. Neither were happy with Turlamund's redeployment of the reserves. Gareth, because most of them were merely militia from around Vanador, and Carmella because her troops were trained in siege warfare and defensive fighting, not marching bravely to their doom in open battle. Yet, despite their scepticism, they dutifully agreed that trusting Turlamund's judgment was likely the best course of action. I was long done with my meal before I finished with Carmella, and the hour was growing later, and I was exhausted. Without notifying anyone, I travelled through the ways to the Waystone in Spellgarden Tower, where I immediately fell onto the cot I kept in my workshop in full armour and fell blissfully asleep for a few hours. It was late afternoon, nearly dusk, when I woke. I needed the rest, badly, I realised when I woke up. But considering how my back ached, it probably would have been wiser to remove my armour. Between the pace, the stress, and the physical exhaustion implicit in war magic, especially the lingering effects from using the snowflake's powerful energies, both my body and mind needed the respite, desperately. I also needed to rearm and prepare for the specifics of the coming battles. I spent a few minutes switching out war wands, grabbing some battlefield enchantments, replenishing my supplies, and gathering a few experimental constructs I was playing around with. I had no idea what the future held, but I wanted to be prepared. I felt better going into the unknown with a few more nasty surprises hanging from my weapons harness. The quiet of the estate was a stark contrast to the din of siege warfare I'd endured for a few days. and I realized that I would much prefer to be in Spellgarden, plotting out my tomato garden, than fighting Gavanni and enshadowed in the wilderness. I glanced out a window as I descended the stairs to the lower chamber, and I could see the many terraces and planters of the grounds bursting with luscious new growth. I had a sudden impulse to spend the rest of the evening pulling weeds, but I overcame it. When I stepped off the bottom step and into the main hall, I was surprised to see two visitors sitting and drinking in front of the cold fireplace. I hadn't expected to find anyone here, save the skeleton staff that remained, after all able warriors had been called to the front. But two of the comfortable chairs were occupied by Janik and my arcanist, Heath. "Gentlemen," I said, part greeting and part question. "I wasn't expecting you, was I?" "You'd be a better mage than you are if you did," conceded Heath. "No, I came to drop off a scroll detailing my recent findings and happened to run into this fine fellow," he said, raising his glass to the bard. "And I came by with a fresh intelligence report when I saw this clearly educated gentleman wandering around the grounds," Janik supplied. "As you were absent, I took it upon myself to act as host and engage in a little hospitality. With your liquor," he added. "Once we had a third companion, it seemed an excellent excuse to converse and while away a few hours in our otherwise stressful day." "A third?" I asked, confused. "Who else is squatting in my tower?" "I hesitate to call it squatting, Menelan," the familiar voice of Forseti called, as a little contraption rolled out from behind Janik's chair. "It was a valuable social exchange of ideas and knowledge. It was the thing we'd discovered in Iron Hill's cavern, the ancient device that had intrigued Lelastian so much. It rolled on its six little wheels with alacrity, nimbly avoiding the footstool Janik was using." "Forseti?" I asked, uncertainly. "Indeed," the machine agreed. "Gareth helped attach my main processor to the chassis of this drone. Ordinarily, that's an extreme measure involving diagnostics or programming. However, in this instance, I was able to connect to the unit's power supply and have successfully regenerated a portion of my capacity. In addition, the unit's sensor array finally allows me multiple data inputs," Forseti informed me with what I might mistake as pride. "I can now see the things that you have described to me, among other benefits." The machine rolled forward and I noted that there was a bottle and two more small glasses on its back. I sighed. I really didn't need this kind of distraction, I knew. I was on my way to a battle. Yet the collection of interesting people in my hall was so compelling that I found a third chair and sat. I could spare an hour, I figured. "So, what have you learned that you did not know when you were blind?" I asked, genuinely curious about the answer. "That the colony was, in large part, successful in establishing a viable and sustainable culture," Forseti answered. I don't know how, but the previously tinny voice of the construct was louder and deeper in timbre. "And that the human, evolved response to the planetary quantum field effect is every bit as developed as you suggested." "I think he's talking about magic," Janik suggested, as he swallowed the last of his spirits. "He's decidedly talking about magic," agreed Heath, "in a particularly obscure manner. That's good to hear, considering it's my life's work. Few in the original colony thought that much would arise from the effect," Forseti lectured. "In fact, it was considered a minor, localized phenomenon that humanity would never connect with, much less perfect as a discipline. I also learned that this drone continued to collect data on its route until 78 years after settlement. I have a complete record of the rise of biological specimens that thrived in this region." "Yes, I can see how years of counting squirrels and flowers would be incredibly valuable," Janik said sarcastically. "I'm certain the transformation of this world was intensely interesting," Heath said diplomatically. "But the greatest advantage for our mechanical friend's new attire is the fact that he can get out of that god's damn cave you had him in, Menelan. This is far more convenient," he said, raising his glass in salute. "The drink is better, too." It has also allowed me to restore some of my secondary functioning and increase my interaction significantly, Fossetti reported. I believe I can be far more useful in this configuration. Let us find out, Janik mused. We were just discussing the current situation and how to contend with it. Our well-wheeled friend here believes that there might be solutions within our ancient past that could apply. With which I completely agree, nodded Heath. Our civilization lost most of our institutional knowledge after the inundation of Perwin. We know our ancestors had insight and power that we can only mimic with magic. Flight, for example, he proposed. Our ancestors were Skylords. They had the ability to take to the air and move at incredible speeds. The craft they used were amazing feats of science, he said, with open admiration. Gareth and I have had long discussions about that. He believes we could recapture some of that knowledge, which could be incredibly useful. We already have birds, Janik said, shaking his head. Our giant falcons cannot ordinarily carry more than a single person, objected Heath. That limits their usefulness. Our ancestors' craft could carry hundreds of people at a time, and tons of cargo. I've done a lot of research into the early settlement period, and it was clear that the greatest of the skyships was larger than most of our seaworthy variety. The New Horizon was equipped with 6 heavy shuttles, reported Fossetti helpfully. Each was capable of carrying up to 380 passengers, or up to 340 tons of cargo. They were rated for orbital insertion, point-to-point transport, and interplanetary travel. In addition, there were over 400 smaller craft, some of a highly specialized nature, that were included in the original colony. Daimler Himmel Corporation began manufacturing smaller electrogravitic vehicles at the Stavoren plant on Perwin 21 years after the colony's founding. None of which have survived, Janik observed, so that's hardly useful. It is, Heath insisted, and we don't know that none of them survived. That knowledge still exists somewhere in the world. Fossetti has explained the basic concepts and says he could design a simple craft that could fly. Nothing with the capabilities of the ancients' craft, but it would be a start. As helpful as my recent upgrade has been, the machine agreed, it lacks output devices that allow me to share graphic depictions that would be essential in such an experiment. I am hopeful that further discoveries of surviving equipment will rectify that. We're a little busy to be searching out ancient ruins right now, I explained. We're in the middle of another war, and one that is, well, it's not going as well as we'd hoped. On that subject, I would welcome your insights, Fossetti, I proposed. Is there anything in your memories that would have an immediate effect on our victory? Without substantially more data on the conditions, it would be difficult to advise you, I'm afraid, the machine said. Unfortunately, military tactics and combat scenarios were not part of my primary or secondary functions, particularly archaic military tactics against an alien army. The ancients had a much different approach to such things, thanks to their tekka, Heath agreed. They didn't go hacking at each other with swords and axes and lances. They shot each other with sophisticated tekka weaponry, like gentlemen. There are no gentlemen in Shakathet's horde, I said, shaking my head. There are enshadowed sorcerers and nemavorti, siege worms and trolls, and they are crushing our castles like toys. Turlaman has ordered a regrouping in the hopes of luring Shakathet into a field battle, but I'm concerned about our chances even then, I informed them sadly. I go from here back into battle. You don't sound hopeful, Janik observed. I'm hopeful, but I'm also realistic. Nor does it appear if the wisdom of the ancients is going to make a difference in the outcome. Things could go very, very amiss if we are unlucky, I admitted. But you're hopeful, Janik smirked. I don't really have much choice. But our army is strong, well-armed, and largely intact thus far. Our commanders have done well under the circumstances. and we have made some important gains, such as capturing a number of enshadowed witchstones. They're larger and more deadly than ours, by design. They could prove very helpful in the coming struggle. Be careful with those things, Minlan, warned Heath. Very little is known about the enshadowed, because the Alka'alon are ashamed of them and don't like to tell us much about them. But what we do know indicates that they were real bastards and adept at warfare. A relatively small number of enshadowed was able to stand up to the combined might of the three kindreds, he reminded me, for centuries. And even after they were crushed, they lingered in the deep places and plotted until they were ready. Their weapons might be powerful, but they could also be dangerous for us to use. Ah, the pretty jewels of the ugly Alka'alon, mused Janik. They ever delighted in waving those things under everyone's nose back in the penumbra. They didn't hesitate to use them either. That's what broke the power of the Urgul Nosti shamans and sent King Ashakal into exile. I hated those arrogant bastards. Well, I'm facing those arrogant, powerful bastards in the field now, I pointed out, and their spellcraft lives up to its reputation, I'm afraid. They are not without their weaknesses, Heath considered. According to some of the epics, the enshadowed sorcerers were greatly empowered by their Irionite, but the price of using was that it cut them off from the consensus, whatever that means. They must be speaking about the group entertainment effect that the Alon manifest, I proposed. That is interesting. That much power must overwhelm their natural ability to form whatever kind of gestalt they use. Perhaps I can make use of that. It doesn't stop them from domineering their own troops, Heath warned. Indeed, I think that's part of the design. But without one to study, it would be difficult to establish the mechanism for one sort of consensus over the other. I'll see if I can pick one up on the battlefield, assuming I survive, I said dryly. Could you? Heath asked, ignoring my sarcasm. That would be helpful. Yes, and could you make the battle a little more interesting while you're at it? Janik added. Have the foe used the secret weapon that our Chandler friend told us about? Thankfully, no. Or Megalyn Castle likely would have fallen already. From what he said, it moves slowly. But if he speaks truthfully, when it arrives, then I would imagine that things will get quite a bit more interesting, I reminded him darkly. That would be excellent, Janik said, unconcerned about the potential destruction it would cause. It will help with the propaganda if there was something really special about it, or spice up your eulogy if things don't go well. I mean, garden variety valor is so very banal at this point. I'll see what I can do, I said, standing and stretching. As lovely a diversion as this is, gentlemen, I have some garden variety valor to put in for the war effort. I'll let you know if I survive. Do try to leave some spirits for me, if I do. I make no promises, Janik said, pouring himself another glass. You have exquisite taste in liquor. I suggest you depart immediately. Before the rain begins, Fossetti recommended. Rain? I asked curiously. Yes. This new unit is limited in its field of observation, but it does have an adequate sensor array for collecting geophysical data, including temperature, humidity, barometric pressure, and other means of making weather observations. When comparing the current data with a historical review, it would appear that there is a likely chance of a long period of precipitation in the near future, within the next 4 to 6 days, depending on the system. Ah, yes, it is about the time of year for the cloud soakers, Janik agreed. After the spring floods, there's nothing like a week of rain to raise one's spirits. It does help the crops, though, he conceded, not so much the travelling to the next venue. That's actually very interesting, I said, suddenly struck with an idea. In fact, that might be the most interesting thing to come from this conversation. Farewell, gentlemen. I must return to Megalyn Castle for a brief conversation with Terlaman before I return to the field. Do enjoy the drinks. That sounds like a sovereign command to me, Janik said, refilling each glass from the decanter. Oh, look, I poured one for Fossetti. I suppose I shall just have to enjoy it on his behalf. I exited the ways near Asterol, whose stone I'd used to make the journey. He was encamped in a small vale, about 3 ridges over from the exit of the Iron Hill Tunnel, among the castle's infantry he'd recruited to make the march. They didn't look particularly happy about it, as they made preparations for a journey that might well lead to their demise. I knew that look. I'd worn it myself while marching down the Faresian Peninsula. Astaroth didn't have that expression. Indeed, the Baron of Lasara seemed well at ease in his campaign tent. It was one of only a few that had appeared, but that was more than I expected. Many of the war magi had them, I saw, freestanding canopies they carried in hoxter pockets for such occasions, though nowhere near as sophisticated as mine. A grand canopy that you didn't have to carry had become a popular enchantment at the Bouleuterion. "Welcome back, Menelon," he called pleasantly as an iron bandsman brought him a trencher of food. "We're just having dinner before we set off. The fellows aren't looking forward to a forced march at night, but they would rather not get discovered by the army that's pillaging the ruins of Ironhill Castle, so we'll be departing at dusk." "Not a moment too soon," I said, drawing a campaign chair out of my own collection of hocksters in my baculus. "I've just returned from Megalyn and Terlamen, where we hashed out a decent plan," I said, and then described the short but intense discussion that resulted in the alteration of his original plan. "He's convinced that if we choose the right battlefield, that we can make our smaller numbers less of a factor in the outcome." "I love it how Terl considers piles of dead and acres of wounded to be factors in the outcome," Astaroth chuckled. "I suppose you have to do what he does. You'll be happy to hear that all 2,800 civilians departed at noon, laden with all of Iron Peg's stores and treasures, headed for Bramon Tor with an escort of 100 infantry. I sent Barroso along with them, as well as a few of the other war magi. They will keep interfering with the enemy's scrying to obscure them along the way. I'm hopeful of the chances." "Ours?" he said, indicating the infantry around us. "I'm not as certain. We have as good a chance as we ever get," I shrugged. "Already there are forces at work that aren't apparent, on both sides. It gets a little confusing, actually. But I think a few days of marching will help clear our heads. We'll be joining a few units along the way, and Carmella, or one of her deputies, will meet us at the other end of the march. She will be leading the tower companies," I explained. "And bring a great many new toys to play with on the battlefield, too, I wonder. She dresses like a sloppy artisan, but I can't fault her craft. For our part, we have nearly 30 war magi in our little unit now, and a few of them are extremely pissed off after being abducted and held in the mines. And I am so looking forward to trying out my new bauble," he said, displaying the thick sphere of Irionite on his palm. "You've been studying it?" I asked curiously. "I've been exploring it while you were gone. Landric and I have been comparing notes about our new baubles. It's absolutely amazing," he assured me, staring into its depths with unrestrained fascination. "There are levels of sophistication in this stone that are unmatched by what I've seen of the Alka Alon's work. Song spells? This jewel could shatter a mere song spell with a thought. I'm still learning what the base symbology represents, but it's far less organic and more orderly than typical Alka Alon magic. Heath the Butler wants me to remind you that strange magical artifacts captured from our enemies might be dangerous to dabble with," I mentioned. "It has occasionally led to cataclysmic consequences, long quests and evil dark lords, according to lore. Heath the Butler can fetch me a drink of his maiden aunt's prized pomegranate punch and keep his lore and his opinions to himself," dismissed Astaroth. "Even the 7 stones you gave to your best people are no match for these. These are designed to be weapons, first and foremost. And I never dabble," he assured. "You'll have the chance to prove it in a few days," I smiled. "Even after we join with the reserves, we're going to be outnumbered. We'll need every war mage on the field. Speaking of which, I have it on good authority that Count Anvaram has arrived at Varone with his army," I informed him. "It seems he has made good on his pledge to invade the Mage Lord to rescue your fiancée from you." "The old bastard actually came and made it all the way to Varone?" snorted Astaroth, amused and impressed. "You really got to him, Menelon. Even though Matherion wasn't in Lasara, he insisted on burning a few villages on his way through, just to be spiteful. I never thought he'd make it as far as northern Gilmora. It's taken everything I can do to get him that far. I've done everything but lead his horse for him, I chuckled. Planus, Ruderal, and Atapala shadowing them and passing along reports. They say he'll lead his army out of Verone in the next day or so. Ha! Vengeance, Astaral sighed. It's quite flattering in its way. An entire army raised to punish me. It's enough to make a man have an inflated sense of his own importance. How do you deal with it, Menelan? He asked, semi-seriously. I surround myself with loud and obnoxious fellows to distract my enemies from knowing what I'm doing, I riposted. Keep it up. You're doing an excellent job. It's nice to know my education wasn't a total waste. Seriously, Menelan, this spat with Gilmora could have long-term consequences, he said, completely seriously. I'm as pro-Alshar as anyone, but Castal has had a grip on the country for 50 years, and it doesn't look any less tight. If you go putting ideas of liberation into their heads, the pro-Alshari aristocracy may end up emboldened, and then do something rash. It's necessary. The long-term consequences don't concern me. Anguin would love nothing better to take Gilmora away from Castal, but he's preoccupied right now. And if Alshar could not support their claim, then it would be foolish for the Gilmoran aristocracy to stage an uprising right now, particularly with what is happening in the Westlands. Apart from Cartan, Gilmora's greatest treasure is its foolishness, Astaral insisted. Hence my amazement that Count Anvaram actually managed to lead an army. I wouldn't credit him with the wit to find his arse with both hands. Yet he has done something no other Cartan lord has. To my knowledge, this is the first time Gilmora has invaded somewhere else, instead of being invaded. They aren't really a concern at the moment, I admitted. The news from Megalyn is the Outer Bailey has been breached, and the Gavani are pushing toward the inner castle wall. Despite his cheerful demeanor, Astaral winced. I thought Azar wasn't going to let that happen. Azar didn't. But it did happen, and the Megalini have had to pull back. Azar did get one little cavalry charge out of it, though, and had evacuated most of the civilians when it became likely the wall would fall. But now they are assailing the castle proper. Oh, and Markadine is still holding out Preshar Castle, even though the lake that protected it was the one used to destroy Iron Hill. Not that it did the enemy much good. Marching across a muddy lake bed and then up a steep incline against a 25-foot wall isn't going to be much fun. Not when Wilderlords are shooting at you. Turlman expects Markadine to be able to hold out indefinitely. Well, we'd best not put this off much longer. Astaral sighed and stood. I followed suit. I'll have your horse brought around. We captured a few when we intercepted the prisoners, and we have a few renegades who were lingering around to escort our colleagues to Korbal. The usual Penumbra scum who don't mind making a profit from both sides. I thought you might like to question them at some point, so we're dragging them along with us as we march. In chains, he added. They can be put to work digging latrines when we arrive, I chuckled. Where are we going anyway? He asked, curious, as he put away his new stone. Some of the fellows were asking, and I ran out of inscrutable things to say a few hours ago. Telemann is still being obscure about the preparations, but our orders send us 2 miles from the Anfal River. Telemann thinks we can make an initial stand there. Some place called Stannis Howe. Chapter 25. The Mistress of the Field. Believe it or not, I didn't mind marching at night. I'd done it in Faerys often enough, before cat's eye spells were common or easy. Back then, the night marches were respite from the oppressive heat and humidity, trading the inconvenience of rain for the challenge of marching on sizzling hot rocks or volcanic sand. The insects were slightly less active at night, too. This time I was mounted on a decent horse, leading a column of infantry, and the weather was neither oppressively hot nor wet. Yet, the skies were still clear, though I could feel the change in air pressure Forseti had foretold. The stars were brilliant guides, along with a sliver of moon, as we quietly travelled overland toward our destination. Astaroth had used his new witchstone to cast the wards that prevented our troops from being seen by the enemy. He had discovered, during his arcane investigation of the thing, certain patterns of observation the Enshadowed used in the scrying that we were unaware of. Some of them were effective in scrying past our wards, due to their different approach. Astaroth fixed that problem with some tweaking of the magical field of the warding spell, and we were underway without much danger of being observed. Of course, physical scouts could still see us. The cloud of dust that inevitably arose as 1,000 men and a score of horses tromped by would give us away, at least in the daylight, hence our nighttime movement. It was an organized march, too. The peasant militia and men-at-arms of Iron Hill weren't particularly disciplined, but the Iron Bandsmen who marched with us were, and they helped keep the lines orderly and the column from becoming stretched out. We had such an abundance of war magi with us that a cavalry force to screen our advance would have been redundant. Morale was likewise good, though they had just escaped the destruction of a strong castle with their lives. Looting the treasury and storehouse of a despised liege lord can do wonders for a peasant's morale. More than 400 had died in the attack. It would have been nearly 4,000 had they not escaped through Iron Peg's tunnel. A long march on a warm spring night was not too high a price to pay for that. Toward midnight, we encountered the first of the additional bands that we would be joining, a 30-man detachment of militia who had been on the way to Iron Hill when the siege began. They were grateful to be joining such a large group, after dodging Gavanni patrols for a week. Around dawn, we found the second, a dozen horsemen from some place called Tarwell, who were late in heeding the banner call. I had no idea where Tarwell was, or who was in charge. It occurred to me, not for the first time, that I was still largely ignorant of the realm I now ruled. My gentleman and I spent the time on horseback discussing the tactical plan, as well as speculating on contingencies that might arise. When we exhausted that topic, we turned to news and gossip, and then to war stories. By the time we made camp on a small rise just after dawn, we had ridden more than 25 miles. The next day we slept and rested until early afternoon, and then we pressed on. In the early evening we encountered a troop of Gavanni on some foul errand, or I should say, they encountered us. 100 Maragorku warriors, nearly man-sized and well-armed, were moving across the field when they stumbled into our vanguard. They attacked, thinking they were merely mopping up resistance, and then suddenly had 1,000 Humani warriors thunder down on them, slaying them all. It was a much-needed victory for our footsore soldiers, and by midnight the column was underway with spirits much lifted by the fight. Just after midnight, we met the first of the tower companies that Turlaman had deployed. He had ordered each of the towers to send all but the last of their reserves to join us, and the one farthest from the field was the one that arrived first. The banner of Eastguard Tower flew over the long caravan of supplies and a lamentably small detachment of infantry. But one doesn't count magi like one does lances. The reason for the early deployment was Eastguard's stern commander, Mistress Marsden. While some tower keepers ran their keeps like a school or a workshop, Marsden ran hers like a military camp. She had recruited a sizable garrison at Eastguard over the past 4 years, many selected from escaped slaves. Indeed, her facility had become known for the quality of garrison soldier it trained. That led to the other towers hiring men from Eastguard for their own garrisons, while Marsden kept the best for herself. She was known as the Mistress of the Field for a reason, and it had nothing to do with crops. So, it was no surprise that when the call came to move, Marsden's people were on the road before the day was done. She led them herself, on the back of a grey gelding, in full armour. She wore a dark yellow cloak over her shoulders, and her helmet bore a long horsehair crest in the style of some mercenary companies. Her jaw was set defiantly in the moonlight, and she saluted as we approached. "Count Menelan! Baron Astaroth!" she boomed, when we came near enough to be heard. "Welcome to the field!" "Mistress," I said, returning the salute. "In truth, we've been afield for a while now. Thank you for joining us. You received Telemann's orders?" "I did, and it's about time we brought our forces to bear," she said proudly. "Eastguard is ready to defend." "My lady, "Forgive me for noticing," Astaroth said, his Gilmoran accent coming out when he was being gracious, "but this seems a small number for a tower as important as Eastgard. Indeed, there were only 100 infantrymen behind the wagons that lined the road. That's because I sent the other 400 directly to the meeting point," she said, matter-of-factly. "I saw no need to run their boots off when a small escort for the spellmonger's troop would suffice. We're here to give your people cover," she explained, as her horse joined ours. "You have a report?" I asked the doughty war mage. No doubt the absence of the Iron Hill garrison was noticed by Shacketh's army when they finally took the walls. According to intelligence, they have broken camp and are pursuing you with all speed, she replied. The armies at Fort Destiny have also taken to march and are headed in this direction. And from my last discussion with Megalyn Castle, now that the Outer Bailey is breached, the Scruggs think they have the place beaten. They're redeploying a goodly number now that they're starting to realize that there is another army afield. Well, I'd hate for this war to be too easy, Astaroth nodded. What is the most recent plan? You're to head to Stannis Howe, she directed, manifesting a mage map in the air. We're to cover your movements, and then add some adjustments to the wards to confuse the issue. I've got my troops at Stannis Howe already, including 100 heavy infantry who are itching for a fight. We're to hold that hill until Turlaman's order. Then we break and head east for the river. Where Mavone's stolen bridge will let us cross, but not Shacketh. Astaroth nodded. The Anfal is deep around there, too. Not much chance of a ford. So how many at Stannis Howe? I asked as we rode. Thus far, only a few thousand, Marsden said, shaking her head. But there's more on the way. 3,000 reserves should arrive before we get there, and another 2,000 after we arrive, perhaps more. The others are preparing our retreat. Our mission is to stand up to whatever legions Shacketh sends against us, bloody their noses, and then run like hell. The idea is to get them to bring their secret weapon out in the open so that we can challenge it, I explained. Telemann knows that their control over it is tenuous, and they can likely only use it once. We're to give them the best target we can to lure them to do so, and run their legs off so that they're tired once they get to the battlefield we've chosen. It's a sound plan, Marsden agreed, as she took her corncob pipe out of her belt and packed it. We're finished if we try to win this through enduring a siege. I heard what happened at Destiny and Iron Hill, she added grimly. It's clear that ordinary castles are just not going to survive, even without dragons. But this will give us a chance to show what we can do in the field. My people have been preparing for this sort of thing for 4 years now, she assured. Carmella has had all the fun up to now. It's our turn. I appreciated her eagerness for battle, even if I didn't share it. I've been in all sorts of battles, but I prefer to be behind a wall or a ditch, or a rather large army, or, preferably, all three. As much as I trusted Turlaman, I was concerned. If Marsden was straining at the bit to cross swords with Shacketh, well, that was something. She proved good on her word, too. One of the first things that she did was deploy two wagons behind the column, each configured to cast and carry a sophisticated array of battlefield enchantments, after she had a long mind-to-mind conference with Turlaman and got a better idea of what he desired strategically. Then she consulted with Astaroth and Landric over the insights they had divined from their acquaintance with their new orbs. That allowed her to tune the enchantments to tell the enemy only what we wanted them to know, or believe. It's not that we don't want them to see us, she explained to us, after she set the magic in motion. We just don't want them to really see us. When scrying, the enemy will see our column, but offset by 2 miles to the west and south. And every mile we travel, it appears as if our force grows by a tithe, she said with satisfaction. Inaccurate scrying was always an issue on campaign, I knew from experience. But the issue usually lies in detecting enemies, not in detecting enemies who were not there. As a result, many commanders elected to add some number of foes to the intelligent scrying reports they received on the belief that they were missing some. Marsden's wards countered that and added more to our number, if you were casually scrying us out. While it was true that we were adding to our numbers as we marched, as smaller units joined us, our numbers seemed far increased with every step we took. "More," she continued eagerly, "we're projecting a number of spells to confuse direct observation. These woods and fields are filled with Skrug scouts," she assured me. "When we're in range of their observations, they will see and report very different troop compositions. Some will tell of our large artillery train, while others will comment on the number of heavy infantry, or perhaps a troop of cavalry. Regardless of their observations, their reports will confuse the issue badly, back at their headquarters. They won't know where we are, what we are, or where we're really going until we get there. They will move their troops accordingly, and that will give us the time we need to get into position. Won't they feel disappointed when they arrive? And there are far fewer of us than they thought?" Astral asked conversationally. "One would hope," chuckled Marsden. "That's part of Turlerman's plan, to get them to commit their reserves against a force they think is much larger than it is. Of course, being such a smaller force, we're going to have to take some damage," I sighed. "At least, that's a possibility. If my people do what they're supposed to do, and things play out the way we plan, that should be a minor consideration," Marsden suggested. "The goal here is to get them to throw their best blow against a target that will fold up and leave them staggering. And while they're recovering, we run like hell across the river," she said, nodding. "That forces them to cross the river to face us." "And then what?" Astral asked. "Turlerman hasn't really told me," Marsden confessed, "but I'm sure it will be good." "Turlerman likely hasn't figured it out," Astral chuckled. "Not that I have any brilliant plan, but those who think Turl knows exactly what he's doing are mistaken. I applaud his ability to visualize his goals, but he's wise enough to keep them fluid until events reveal themselves." "A sign of a good commander," Marsden approved. "Perhaps in a siege you can plan and plot, but things can change quickly on the field of battle. Adaption and improvisation count for more than strategy, or even tactics. I find myself well served by Mage Lord Turlerman's command," she insisted. "I've had worse commanders," Astral agreed. "How far to Stannis Howe?" he asked. "We should reach it by dawn," Marsden assured. "Anguin's Tower arrived first and began constructing redoubts. Carmella's folk are there by now, erecting the siege engines. I'm looking forward to her field artillery. That's much different than siege artillery," she informed us. "But all of it will have to be abandoned when Turlerman commands. I hope she's prepared for that." "Much of it will be portable by Hoxter," I pointed out. "Carmella knows what is at stake." We marched along with determination, but the pace slowed by necessity just as we arrived at Stannis Howe. Not because the men were exhausted, they were, but because we encountered a line of wains and horses attempting to gain entry to the battlefield. The Free Company of Verone, as it turned out. I left the Iron Hill troops to Astaroth's command and rode forward with my original team, because I was the spellmonger and I hated waiting in line and I could do that sort of thing. I didn't really think much of the sight as I rode along the side of the trail, passing wagons and troops shuffling forward. That is, until I made the rise and saw why Turl had chosen it. Stannis Howe is a low hill, no more than 70 or 80 feet high, but the slopes that led to the crest were steep and broad, giving those at the top a commanding height over any who dared to assail them. The fields around the hill were mostly barren of trees, as they had been used for pasture by the locals, but the crest was crowned with a thick grove of trees that provided significant cover. Our forces had taken command of the little forest at the peak and occupied a circle 100 feet beyond the tree line. Already, ditches and redoubts were being built to protect the rise, where a growing number of our troops were preparing to make a stand. A small village of tents and canopies bloomed across the western edge of the forest, and I could see, in the light of the dawn, a number of magical field fortifications, like the Southern Fortress, only smaller and more numerous, as well as a few small engines being assembled. It was a busy place, with a frenetic feeling somewhat like Spellgate had last autumn, when we were preparing for war. In the fields below the summit, a squadron of war magi was placing enchantments and spell fields, while peasant militia built small redoubts or moved rocks and dirt to prepare the battlefield appropriately. Cavalry, mostly Wilderlords, patrolled the edges of the site, screening for spies and snipers. Most importantly, I noted, a trail was being cut down the eastern slope of the hill. That was our means of escape once the order was given. From here it was only 2 miles to the river, where Mavone was ready to deploy the bridge our enemy had so helpfully prepared for us. I spent the morning visiting with the commanders of the various units that had gathered, and tried not to get in their way while they prepared. I eventually led my men to the region where the magical corps was setting up. True to her word, most of Marsden's people were already at work, minding the wards and scrying the local regions. Another section was preparing to facilitate battlefield communications, while another was busy with defensive spells appropriate to the battle plan. It was fascinating to watch a battle where war magi were directing the strategy and tactics. Perhaps I'm being overly generous to my colleagues, but they paid far more attention to detail than their mundane counterparts. Maybe it was their study of magic, and the necessity of not letting one thing go attended lest we court disaster. But the efficiency with which the war magi worked was a refreshing difference from the way the aristocratic cavalry usually ran things in a battle. That reminded me of something important. I ordered my team to encamp at the edge of the magical corps section, and I placed my pavilion as an example. It would be a day at least before we were likely to see action, and I wanted them to rest after the last few busy days. I got into contact with planners, mind to mind. I needed to check on my own surprise. "Has Anvarum left Verone yet?" I asked eagerly. "No, I'm afraid not," Planner said, clearly disappointed. "But not for lack of me trying. It appears that his men are enjoying the lustier side of the town and are reluctant to depart, and there are rumours that the Lord Steward is prohibiting him to pass Verone." "Please, tell me you're joking," I insisted, as I visualized an elaborate plot failing because of the winsome whores of Verone and a stubborn governor. "I wish I was," Planners sighed mentally. "But despite my quiet urging, these Gilmoran sots want to experience campaign life away from their wives. The prospect of heading back out into the Wilderlands to chase the dreaded spellmonger just isn't as alluring." "Dreaded?" I asked in disbelief. "I'm dreaded? If you were an effete Gilmoran gentleman, would you rather face the unknown danger of a legendary sorcerer in the wilderness? Or would you prefer the charms of a young Wilderlands maiden in the comfort of an inn?" "I think maiden might be too strong a term," I suggested, "but I take your point." "Damn Ishi. She warned me this would happen to Verone. They really aren't moving? Every morning the steward of the campaign announces another delay, for another pointless reason," Planners complained. "It's as if they really don't want to go to war or something." I sighed. "Damn it. I'm preparing for a battle right now, but, well, I can't let this wait," I decided. "Let me see if I can slip away for a few hours and settle this. Are the boys nearby?" "Ruderal is. Atapol has been out keeping an eye on the troops. Shall I call him in?" "Yes," I ordered. "I think I'm going to need his special assistance with this." None of the commanders on Stannis Howe were pleased that the spellmonger wanted to go jaunt off to somewhere else when there were reports of the first large band of Gavanni only 7 miles away. But I took advantage of being a powerful wizard, able to appear and disappear mysteriously on cryptic missions of an urgent nature. I placed Astoral in charge of my little unit, went over the preparations we discussed, and then I took the ways to appear before Planus in Verone. "Don't you look martial," Planus said as he welcomed me to his room. He had, of course, taken residence in one of the finer inns in town, one across the street from the new Verone Castle. He was not dressed in his usual Remiran finery. He wore a striped blue and yellow shirt under a ragged leather vest, both showing the sorts of wear that a merchant or artisan might incur. He looked nothing like the obscenely wealthy aristocratic adept that he was. "I was just at a battlefield," I pointed out as I stripped off my helmet and weapons harness and began pulling off my armour. "But it would be pleasant not to carry around 50 pounds of dragon scale if I don't need to. Where are the boys?" "Ruderal is downstairs, fetching luncheon," Planus informed me as he helped pull my breastplate over my head. "Would you like to join us? You can get anything but cheese. Everyone's cows have run off, apparently, and there's no cheese nor butter in all of Verone. Atipol is on his way back. What is your plan? He asked, intrigued. First, I'm going to talk to the Lord Steward of the City, I explained, as I unfastened my underharness. Then I will goad Count Anvaram into moving his lazy ass out of Verone, hopefully in time for me to make it back to the battle. It sounds like a full day, he noted, as Ruderal entered bearing a tray. Just put it over there, boy. Your master has arrived.
Master Min,
Ruderal said excitedly as he plopped the tray down on a table and unexpectedly embraced me.
I was wondering when I'd see you again.
Are you enjoying Verone? I asked, giving him a pat before I continued removing my armor.
It's all right,
he conceded. I liked Gilmora better. The girls here are, well, they're different, he said, blushing. They're the same as Gilmoran girls, I countered. They're just less discreet about it. Blame Ishii. I know I do. Do you need to borrow some civilian clothes? Planus asked when I finally stripped off the padded gambeson. Or do you prefer to walk around naked? In this town? Not a chance. But I brought my own, I said, as I searched my collection of hoxter pockets and found the right one. In a moment, I had a full set of sophisticated robes suitable for an urban expedition, including shoes that were much less brutal-looking than the hobnailed boots I'd arrived with. Help me get it on, and let's go see the Lord Steward. Sir Kersal, Ducal Steward of Verone, kept his residence in the palace complex of the newly built Verone Castle, where he conducted the business of the city on Duke Anguin's behalf. That was a lot of business at the moment, I saw, as the streets were filled with Gilmoran knights and the mercenaries they'd brought, in addition to the thousands of Verone citizens who required his attention. There was a long queue outside of the palace, where the city watch kept a vigorous presence to keep order and protect the castle. But wizards don't wait in lines, if they could help it, and I didn't like waiting, so I pulled rank once again. My apprentice and I walked past the long line of petitioners and addressed the castellan at the head. I made sure I was seen, too, by everyone in line. It's hard to miss me in public. If the bright blue robe and mantle I wore wasn't distinctive enough, the pointed hat and mysterious floating green and gold orb that followed me around told everyone who saw me who I was. The megalith is better than a herald that way. Just for effect, I walked with insight, which is pretty clearly a wizard's baculus, in case anyone missed the fact that I was a wizard. I also had my apprentice tagging along behind me with his one single pointed cap. Planus had stayed behind, as he did not want to reveal himself as my ally. It was certainly sufficient for the clerk from the castellan's office. He took one look at me, bowed deeply, and pushed the parchment he was reading aside. Within 5 minutes I was being escorted into Kersal's chambers.
My lord count, he said, surprised. When they told me it was you, I thought it a mistake. I had word that you were engaged in fighting at Megalyn.
How goes the war? He asked, concerned. He had every right to be. If the mage law fell, Shakathet would sack Verone next. We are hard-pressed, I admitted. We've lost two castles to sorcery, and Megalyn Castle is endangered. The Gavanni have penetrated the Outer Bailey. But Baron Azar holds, I promised. Indeed, I am in the process of preparing our position for another battle in the open field as we speak. Kersal shook his head sadly. I did not think things would go so poorly after this winter's victory. We are a long way yet from defeat, I assured. Indeed, that is why I have come here. I cannot send any more troops, Kersal said apologetically. We have our own defense to look to, and now I have this pesky Gilmoran army that sprang out of nowhere. The commander, Count Anvaram, pretends he will make war on you. Of course, he continued, I could not allow such a thing at such a delicate time. Twice he has asked for leave to depart his troops to storm Vanador, if that is even conceivable, and twice I have forbidden it. To think of pursuing some petty vengeance at a time when the entire realm is threatened, I wonder if the man knows which end of a lance to hold, he said disgustedly. Kersal was not a tournament knight. He had been dispossessed and estranged from his Wilderlord family for years, and instead of languishing among the pageantry of the tourney circuit in Gilmora or the Riverlands, like most gentlemen would, he had been a mercenary for years. Since his establishment in Verone, he had overseen the robust defence of the town during these uncertain times. He was not about to let his accomplishments be trampled by Anverham, or anyone less than his duke. "I can't fault your judgment, my lord," I chuckled, "but in this case, that is exactly what I want you to do. I ask a boon. Allow Anverham and all of his host to proceed against me," I proposed. Kersal looked both sceptical and surprised. "Allow him to proceed? Why, he seeks to make war on you. They might look too pretty to fight, but there are nearly 5,000 knights and men-at-arms in their company, and 2,000 mercenaries. I know the spellmonger is mighty," he conceded, "but to face such a force when you are already challenged by the Gavanni..." "The Gavanni are the least of my problems," I dismissed. "The spellmonger is mighty, if I might use the third person, but he is also subtle, crafty, and wise. Trust me, Kersal," I urged. "I can contend with Anverham. In fact, I want him so mad at me he could spit. That seems trivial, considering how irate he was when he made his case. He had the nerve to mention his close friendship with Prince Tavard 9 times, as if I would see the patronage of the Duke of Castell as a benefit," the proud Al-Shari Wilderlord sneered. "He suggests that he makes war on the prince's behalf clandestinely." "Well, it is Tavard's gold that fills the purses of Anverham's army," I conceded, "so you might hold out for a bribe. But that is a long story best told at another time. For now, I merely wish that you give Anverham leave to depart, reluctantly, as if his attempt at using his leverage at court prevailed upon you," I suggested. "You wish to allow this idiotic war to go forward?" he asked in disbelief. "I would like nothing better," I assured him. "Indeed, I have cultivated it for a year." "Very well, then," Kersal finally decided. "If it suits your plans, I shall be glad to be rid of them. We did not plan for an additional 7,000 mouths to feed, and while their coin is welcome in the market, they are driving prices up." "Just encourage them to stay on the eastern bank of the Wild Water," I suggested. "The rains will make it too difficult to cross upriver, and you may have some intelligence that the spellmonger is encamped near the Duns. That should be enough to entice him." "Ah," Kersal nodded knowingly. "You can trust me to pass along that information, reluctantly." We concluded our discussion quickly, and once I'd retrieved Ruderal from the bench, where pages and clerks waited outside his office, I left Kersal to his business and continued on my own. Attapol joined us as we exited the castle, though he looked nothing like the lithe young thief he was. Indeed, he was dressed as a page himself, his white hair dyed dark, and his usually immaculate hands stained with dirt. "I just did my usual patrol of the enemy encampment," he reported, as we walked back toward Planus's Inn. "The officer corps is protesting loudly that the army is not advanced. The knights are reluctant to leave the wildflowers of Verone, and the mercenaries are content to sit in camp and collect their pay. I do believe Count Anverham is feeling the pressure." "He will be allowed to leave today," I assured him, "but before he goes, there's a little errand I'd like you to do, if you're able." 10 minutes later, Attapol disappeared into the crowded streets of Verone, grinning like a fool. Nothing pleases a professional thief more, I'd come to learn, than to provide them a challenge. "So you're headed back to the war now, master?" Ruderal asked as we continued on our way. He sounded both anxious and eager. "Shall I be accompanying you?" "No, Rudy. I want you to stay with Planus for now," I directed. "I need you to ensure that this army advances into the Wilderlands. I need every one of them to be in the Mage Lore. You've done a remarkable job so far, but you're more valuable here than on the field, fetching me drinks and dodging Gavanni." "I'm not scared of goblins," he said defiantly. "Nor am I going to put you in a position where you might be tempted to kill another Nemovort," I lectured. "That would upstage my previous apprentices, after all. You will have to be content to be a spy and a clandestine wizard for now. Besides, I wouldn't want to be the one to have to tell your father you died in battle. There's too much at stake," I reminded him. The boy looked dejected, and I understood. No one likes to be so essential that they can't slip off for a little fun, even if that fun consisted of slaying undead lords. But I could not resist our relationship with the sea mage, Mudrost, when our entire civilization was in the balance. My apprentice would just have to be disappointed. But I did see one way I could cheer him up. I noted a large knot of Gilmoran knights dominating the street, impeding traffic, and generally acting like tourists or pilgrims despite their swords and armor. There were perhaps a dozen of them, part of the contingent that was clearly in no hurry to leave Fair Verone. The locals were annoyed with them and their behavior. I could tell by their expressions, as the arrogant aristocracy of the Cottonlands seemed to have misplaced their customary grace when they arrived in the Wilderlands. They were loud, belligerent, and often crude when it came to the observations of Verone's collective womanhood. "Watch this," I muttered to Ruderal as I used my baculus to target each of the unsuspecting cotton lords. They did not notice me at first, despite my distinctive appearance, but it would not have helped them if they had. Charging the spell and adjusting it slightly to work without direct contact, I waited until one of them, finally, realized that they were standing near to the sworn enemy of their count, the man they had ridden for weeks to fight in battle. "Is that?" one of them said, as the megalith glistened in the sunshine. "It is!" another one called belligerently. Hands went to sword hilts as the men debated, and then decided by consensus that I was, indeed, Count Minolan of the Mage Law. The moment that one took a step toward me with malice in his eye, I activated the spell. The Gut Buster is a favorite of unruly apprentices and vindictive magi. Ordinarily, you would have to touch the victim to activate the spell, which activates the vagus nerve in the human body to explosive and unpleasant effect. But I'm good enough to expand its capabilities and throw the spell at a distance. The moment I did, a dozen knights and squires suddenly vomited and soiled themselves, many sinking to the filthy street as they did so. "A gift from the spellmonger, gentlemen," I said merrily as I passed by them, careful to avoid the growing pool of secretions and retching men. Ruderal smiled in delight as he watched the Gilmorans endure the distress of sudden, uncontrollable diarrhea. "Remember, Ruderal, no matter how dire the circumstance, or how clever the wizard, there is always time for a poop joke." Just then, Astaral sought me out, mind to mind, and I had to pause to communicate with him. "Minolan, you might want to cut your trip short," he reported. "That's a pity," I answered. "I just made a dozen Gilmoran knights shit themselves in the middle of the high street." "You did? You realize how completely crass and crude that is. Probably your Castali upbringing. Do try to remember their heraldry so I can properly gloat about that later," he said, no doubt smiling through the link. "The latest reports show 2 to 3 legions of great goblins massing 3 miles from here. There are more units beyond. Charlemagne sent a dispatch that says that almost 2/3 of the besieging forces at Megalyn have broken and marched away, presumably toward us." "We still have some time, then," I pointed out. "It will take them at least 2 days to get to Stannis Howe. If they attack before reinforcements arrive, we'll eat their lunch." "Oh, I know," he assured. "We don't exactly need you to fight goblins. Keeper Marsden, Mistress of the Field, could handle 2 legions on her own, I would wager. But I figured you'd want to know. It just started raining." Chapter 26. The Battle of Stannis Howe. Evening red and morning grey are sure signs of a fine day. Evening grey and morning red, don your cap or you'll wet your head. Wilderlands folk saying, from the collection of Janik the Rish. Telamon had chosen Stannis Howe as the site of this battle very deliberately. The fairly high crown, the broad sloping hillside, and the forested peak all lent themselves to his vision of the battle. With Mistress Marsden overseeing the complicated, arcane side of the plan, Carmella setting up the artillery, and a sufficient number of troops, it was an excellent position to fight a defensive field battle, particularly in the rain. That had been my contribution to the plan, thanks to Forseti's insight on the subject of weather. Ordinarily, weather is something a soldier just has to accept, and while he might know it will rain in the morn if there are clouds in the sky at dusk, that is about the extent of his ability to predict it. Foreknowledge of the coming rain, including its duration, was an unexpected boon to this battle. You see, Marsden and her fellows from Eastgard Tower, with the help of the war magi I'd brought from Iron Hill, had not only been laying the traditionally lethal spell fields across the broad face of the Howe, but they had included a strong hydrophobic spell on the upper third. It's not a combat spell, and it's pretty simple, actually. It increases the surface tension of water to the point where it would rather flow away than soak into the ground, whereas below that line, a spell field encouraging the soil to absorb water had been cast. The result was that when the rain started, while the top of the hill technically got wet, it was a transitory thing, whereas the water that hit the bottom of the hill, including all the water from the top of the hill, was sucked up by the freshly exposed dirt like a thirsty rag. Marsden's folk had also used agricultural wands and earth elementals to churn up the topsoil around the base of the Howe like a freshly ploughed field. Other spells increased the viscosity of the mud because sticky mud is heavy and annoying. It was a subtle spell, but tactically important. No soldier likes to march in the rain and through the mud, and the furry Gavani like it even less than we do. Their hair absorbs water easily, and most of them don't wear shoes outside of the occasional iron-hobbed sandal. That would be bad enough conditions to work in, but to be asked to charge up a well-defended hill through magically augmented mud would require tremendous effort and inspire powerful resentment. More importantly, it limited the speed of any charge and challenged the leverage of any weapon used on the slopes. Add in a few hidden spikes, some caltrops, incessant barrages of volleyed archery, and a field of insidious spells to further hinder an advance, and I had no doubt that the Gavani would be pressed to get within 200 yards of our lines, about where the hydrophobic spell stopped. Meanwhile, Marsden had ordered every man on the hill to arm himself with a bow. She'd had her engineers construct a long gallery across the crest of the hill, the roof slanted to shield from volleys from the foe while they were able to step out and fire. A long line of ditches in front of the gallery provided additional protection, as did the heavy infantry in front of them. From that position, the heavy Wilderland's bows had a clear field of vision and a range of 250 yards. A second line of archers, lower down the slope, were able to extend their range significantly further, deep past the hydrophobic field. It promised to be a deadly combination. By the time I returned to camp, most of the preparations had been made. The sky was darkly overcast when I arrived, and the rain was coming down steadily. I was intrigued to see the sappers running around with mattocks and shovels, not to dig new defensive trenches, but to scratch shallow channels in the dirt to help direct the flow of the water down the hill. The trenches were as much to protect the defensive works and the camp from the water as they were to add to the mess downhill. "Lovely day for a battle," I told Astaroth as I entered the ornate open canopy that was serving as his headquarters. Astaroth looked up at the steady drizzle. "Perhaps up here," he agreed. "Down there, likely not. But at least they won't have the sun in their eyes. The first legions are getting reinforced as we speak. There is no telling when they will start their attack, but I'm guessing late tonight, perhaps tomorrow." I glanced down the slope. There was a clear demarcation in the dirt where the hydrophobic spell stopped. The longer, the better. I want that hill to be good and muddy. "How did things go in Verone?" he asked casually. "Is there an army coming to rescue my fiancée from me or not?" "Oh, it's coming," I assured. I practically had to draw them a map, but it's coming. "Bide," I requested, as I recognized a mind-to-mind communication evolving. It was Dara. "I'm just flying a patrol south of Megalyn," she reported, "and I think I've spotted that secret weapon," she said, a note of revulsion in her voice. "At least that's what I think it is. It was crossing the river when I saw it, and I circled back for a better look because I didn't believe my eyes. I'm over it now. That's a whole lot of ugly in one place," she assured me. "You saw it? How fast is it moving? How big is it?" I demanded. "It's bigger than we thought, and it's moving more slowly than we expected, but that could be because of the river. And it's absolutely hideous to behold. There's a whole party of handlers? They're shepherding it along. That's the thing you want us to fight?" It won't be as hard as you think, I promised. How do you know? You haven't even seen it, my former apprentice challenged. I don't think anyone has seen one. By the flame, I'm glad I'm in the air. Just stick to the plan, I warned. Do not engage it yet. I don't want to reveal ourselves prematurely. And don't get too close. No chance of that, she insisted. When we flew downwind of it. Gods! The smell! I thought it was going to knock frightful right out of the sky, and we're 500 feet over it. Minilin, if there's more than one of those things. Our intelligence says there's just the one. It's harder to manage than dragons, apparently, and they had to bring it a lot farther. But from what we've heard, once they get it going, it's not something they can easily stop. I don't think we'll be able to easily stop it either, she said doubtfully. Don't worry. I have a plan, I said soothingly. You had a plan at Olam Saheri too, if you recall, she said sourly. We won that one, remember? Because I had a plan. We won that one because we all fought like 9 hells in a basket, she corrected. But you're the spellmonger. I'm assuming that you know what you're doing, and if you don't, I can always fly away. I knew Darrow would never retreat from a fight, not before striking a blow, not even against a dragon. She'd gone aloft and fought the one that attacked Sevendor and had led the effort that had eventually brought it down. But I could see why she might see this particular foe in a different light. Well, they've deployed their secret weapon, I informed Astaroth when I opened my eyes. Dara just spotted it. It's crossing the river and headed this way. And you thought this lovely day couldn't get better, he teased, as the rain chose that moment to pick up the pace. When will it arrive? He tried not to sound worried. A day, perhaps two, but soon. I'm guessing they'll try to soften us up with a few infantry charges and some artillery first, to get us in the mood. But then we get to see if the spellmonger's plan will work, he nodded. But in case it doesn't and I die a horrible death, I hope you can grant me a boon and take charge here for a few hours. I'm meeting Matherian for dinner tonight in Vanador, he informed me. She wants to try the cuisine of the wood dwarves for some reason. It's actually not that far removed from the cuisine of the wilderlands, I observed. But yes, I grant you leave, unless things get hot here and I need you back. So don't get too involved, I warned. This is just dinner, not a chance for a tryst, he corrected. She's in town to retrieve more medical supplies for the hospital and wanted to socialize. In truth, I feel obligated to tell her that Count Anvaram is in Verone now, and headed to rescue her. And, well, I miss her company, he said, a bit embarrassed by the admission. I chuckled. That bodes well for a healthy marriage. Go, take the evening off. Show off your big new ball, I suggested. I can handle things here. Everyone else is handling things here, he pointed out. You're going to sit around and look important. That's what I've done all day in your place. But thank you, Minilin, he said, standing. I appreciate the leave. You've earned it, I conceded. And considering what's coming for us, you'll need your strength. Astaroth wasn't far from wrong. I did mostly sit around camp and look important, because that was all I could do at this point. Most of the pre-combat magic had been laid, and the last reserves we were going to get from the towers made it up the back of the hill in the rain, adding a significant number of horses to our little army. Just before they arrived, a caravan of 10 wagons came in from Salik Tower with a last-minute cargo of magical constructs and other devices Carmella thought would help us hold out. But after they came, the Fellhound scouts started to patrol the area, and we were forced to close the camp and hold the road against them. While I no doubt did look important while I was sitting around, I was also working. I was constantly checking in with Turleman, or one of his staff, to get updates on field intelligence, so that I could figure out when the first attack might come. Though we waited all night for one, our pickets and scouts went unrewarded. The Gavani were staying out of range until they had enough troops to challenge us. Or what they thought were enough troops. Marsden's subtle manipulation of our wards had given us an oversized army, from all the Enshadowed could tell. By midnight that night, we were showing more than double the number of warriors than we actually had present, largely to convince Shakathet to draw off more troops from the ongoing sieges to counter us. That was according to Terleman's plan. A healthy portion of the Megalyn besiegers were already in the field, resolutely marching towards Stannis Howe. Similar, if smaller detachments were coming from Forgemont, and the entire siege armies of Fort Destiny and Iron Hill were pursuing us. I took solace in the fact that they were being force-marched in the unrelenting, constant rain. The field at the base of the hill took on water like a leaky boat, and as a few nimble war magi quietly placed the last few constructs to confound our foes, the sky seemed to open with renewed energy. Puddles formed just about everywhere, except for the crown of Stannis Howe. I could only imagine just how much fun the Gavanni were having trudging through the mud while trying to carry wheeled siege machines over muddy ground and across rivers swollen with rain. It would be a nightmare, I knew. They kept us waiting until almost noon of the next day before the first squadrons of Fellhound riders attempted the slope. It wasn't a bad move, tactically speaking. The hound's great paws had an easier time navigating the mud than horses' hooves would, but that didn't mean it was easy. Dozens managed to climb the muddy incline, only to get perforated by our archers while they struggled through the magically augmented muck. A precious few made it to the dry line, as we had taken to call it, but that just put them in point-blank range. A few other hounds lost their riders, who were lighter and less burdened by the thick mud. They turned back quickly enough when it was clear to all that they did not have the numbers to charge our ranks. The fellhounds eventually retreated, carrying back to their fresh encampment, just out of bowshot. The next wave formed in earnest, just out of bowshot. A long, thick rank of Maragorku infantry lined up in tight, orderly formation. Indeed, as we watched from the heights above, the great goblins raised their broad wooden shields and prepared their weapons with uncanny precision. "The entrainment effect," Landric noted grimly, as we observed with magesight. "Are they doing it on their own, or are they being compelled?"
"I'd say the latter," Timoniel said helpfully. The terror Alon's insight was once again very helpful. "Our ancestors did not think what you call the entrainment effect, or what we call eximilis, was helpful for the Gavanni," he explained, "or so the lore relates. They were more aggressive than the Tal or the Karshak, and more apt to rebel. Granting them coordinated effort seemed a dangerous advantage. Of course, eximilis was still present in them latently, but it took an outside power to bring it to bear."
"Would the Enshadowed have the ability to do such a thing?" asked Barroso. "Domination of will seems to be well within their purview," he observed.
"They pioneered the study," Timoniel said dryly, "in brutal ways. When they could not gain the endorsement of most of the Alka Alon for their radical ideas, instead of accepting defeat and submitting to the consensus, they persisted in ways to impose their will on everyone else, such as bringing the Maragorku into existence, and then using them as shock troops against their own people, and then activating their eximilis to make them more efficient killers. With the right sorcery and sufficient power, one of the Enshadowed could control hundreds of Maragorku."
"They appear to have an abundance of both," Astaroth noted sleepily.
Despite his pledge, the Baron of Lossara had indulged his future bride late into the evening, and had reported for duty looking worn and tired, but very content. "They're marching like they were all controlled by the same set of strings."
"Those puppets bear great axes," Landric pointed out, "and they are as tall as a man, and as well-armoured as any Wilderlord."
"They are as strong as oxen," Timoniel agreed. "The original enchantments included Karshak notes in the song. These appear to have some humani as well."
"Aren't the Karshak stronger than humans?"
Barroso asked.
"For their size and density, yes," I agreed. "But I've had some long conversations on the subject with Lelastian. Humans use their energy more efficiently, have a higher center of gravity, and better leverage with their appendages."
"Must be that pendulous penis," I joked, looking at Timoniel.
If the Terra Alon War Mage was embarrassed, he did not show it.
"It does seem to help," he conceded, apparently not understanding that I was joking.
"It makes you both more cautious and more daring," he concluded, "as if you have more to lose but are willing to risk more for it. An interesting variation on masculinity," he decided studiously.
"Where is Pantandra when you need her?" Astral asked, rolling his eyes.
"We stand on the edge of catastrophe, discussing the comparative way our manhood makes us act,
"As fascinating as that is, gentlemen, and I am a scholar," he urged, "the business at hand is those great goblins, and how terribly wet and muddy they are already. But not a frown in the bunch," he observed. "Yes, well, an intrinsic part of the entrainment effect is to allow the individual to overcome discomfort, pain, or much in the way of independent thought, I'd imagine," I proposed. "They should try at least one initial sortie before they forth a herald," Timoniel informed us. "To do less would be disrespectful to you." "Yes, that's what they did during the Winter War," Barroso recalled. "I suppose if they can wipe us out in one sortie, we aren't worth the herald's time." "Essentially," nodded Timoniel. "The Enshadowed are mavens for that kind of formality. Most of it is hopelessly archaic, left over from our home world. It makes them feel more important, I suppose. The mindless adherence to tradition gives them some sense of legitimacy, I suppose. And the longer they take about it, the more rain falls and the muddier that field gets," Barroso agreed. "Caswallon, are you ready to defend Stannis Howe from the curs that sniff around her hem?" he asked provocatively. Caswallon seemed to start at the mention of his name. "Let them bring their foul designs to the top of this howe with all speed, and set them against the eldritch blade of the fox," he declared, drawing his sword unnecessarily. "Are there no better to face Caswallon than these rabble? Fell hounds? Gavanni? This is no challenge," he boasted, his big nostrils flaring. "Cowards, they be, for they will be mired in the muck of their own wickedness, befouled by the betrayal of both nature and their ruthless masters. Woe to them!" he finished, jutting his jaw into the air, before sheathing his sword. "Yes, he's ready," nodded Barroso, pleased, while Landric rolled his eyes. The charge came shortly thereafter, and I